This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Broadway icon John Cameron Mitchell channels the essence of his glam rock icon, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, for one night only at Arts Centre Melbourne this July. So put on some makeup, turn up the A-track, and pull the wig down from the shelf. John Cameron Mitchell, July 10 at Arts Centre Melbourne. Book now. Joy sponsor.
Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email on air at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
It's Thursday, the 14th of June. Welcome to your nightly news and current affairs show, The Informer. I'm your host, Tom Morgan. Tonight on the show, we talk Hep C and why it's time to focus on getting treatment to the sectors of our communities that aren't accessing treatment, injection drug users. Why now? Why is it so important? And how can we make safe injection spaces even safer for people living with Hep C to access treatment that means that they can live free of Hep C? Plus, we return to this year's Bingham Cup in Amsterdam as we speak to Aussies playing inclusive rugby with teams all around the world and what it's like to face your old team on the field.
This is The Informer, Joy's nightly news and current affairs program. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS us on 0427 Joy 949, email on air at joy.org.au or add us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
The hepatitis C virus is one of several viruses that can cause inflammation of the liver and involves an initial acute phase of infection that may not be noticeable, because in most cases, people do not feel sick. This phase can last up to 6 months. The virus is slow-acting, and it can take many years from initial infection before any permanent damage to the liver, such as scarring, occurs. To access treatment for hepatitis C, it's easy to visit a GP. But what if you don't have or trust your GP? When it comes to Hep C, it's time to start focusing on the parts of our communities who aren't accessing treatment, and safe injection rooms are a great place to start. Darcy Meehan and Dino Curie find out more.
Stephen McNally is the Deputy CEO at the Pennington Institute, a non-profit organisation that works to identify and respond to substance use problems and their causes. The Institute recently held the Hepatitis C and Needles and Syringe Program seminar that focused on a conversation about what's happening in Australia. The Informer's Dina Curie spoke with Stephen earlier to discuss hepatitis C and why, despite a 95% success rate, there are still many people with hepatitis C that are not seeking treatment.
In the past, we have only really offered treatment to people who are no longer injecting. We've offered treatment to people that have been normally they're sort of in their 40s and 50s, and if they did inject it, it was a very, very long time ago. So what's happened over the last 2 years is that we've now, with these new treatments, pretty much treated all those ready and waiting patients, and now we're starting to get to the harder ones. We're getting to the people that are out there in the community. We're getting to the people who are currently injecting. And so it's a new, in many ways, it's new terrain, I guess, for us.
Despite it being new terrain, Australia is actually a world leader when it comes to the treatment of hepatitis C.
Australia is quite unique in that we're offering treatment to everybody. Everybody who has hepatitis C, if you're over 18, you are not only eligible for treatment, but you're encouraged to go on treatment. And in the past, that wasn't the case, because in the past, treatment was so terrible, and that's when the days of interferon treatment. And it was a really hard regime. It took like 12 months. It was a 50% success rate. The side effects were horrendous. And also, there was, if you were someone who was currently injecting, The chances are you would not be offered treatment, you would be discouraged, or you just wouldn't even have a conversation with someone about treatment. So times have changed now, and we, to eliminate hepatitis C, we have to treat everybody, or we have to offer and treat everyone, and that includes the group of people who go to NSPs and the group of people that are currently injecting.
Although there are many Australians who have benefited from the available treatment, there are still many that are hard to reach.
The hard to reach are the people that are still getting infected. There is still some sharing of needles that go on, and we know that that's around 17%. We know that, yeah, for all the infections that are happening now, pretty much, you know, most of them, there are within this cohort. And we do know that that a lot of people who are injecting have been living with hepatitis C for quite a long time, but they're not those people that have been sitting in the hospitals, in the liver clinics, and, you know, hooked in very nicely within those well-established health systems. They're the ones that don't have much to do with the health system, and often needle and syringe programs can be the only place that they really interact with their service. So that's why we need to acknowledge the importance of needle and syringe programs, and that's the big primary ones that are set up just to do needle and syringe exchange, as well as the secondary ones, which are scattered all over the country. That's the key to having those conversations with the people. I'm making it sound easy, but it's not. We have to not only have the conversation, but then we have to work out how do we get people tested? And if someone turns out to be positive, then how do we get them onto treatment? And so what is the pathway? And that sounds simple, but it's a challenging process that you want to make it as simple as possible. You want to make those initial tests to determine whether someone does have hepatitis C. And once you've established that, then it's offering them up treatment, which we are simplifying the models, but it's a very different model to what existed, I guess, within the old days or even a year or 18 months ago within tertiary settings, because the patient was sitting there eager, waiting for the treatment, and that's not the case now. Because in the past, we haven't really wanted to have conversations with needle and syringe program clients around hepatitis C. So, and now we're popping up and saying, hey, we do want to talk to you about this. So it's a new conversation. And the workforce is not necessarily prepared for that conversation as well. So there's training that needs to go on with the workforce. There are still challenges.
The stigma around hepatitis also plays a role, sometimes causing those who benefit most not to seek treatment.
We haven't solved the stigma, the discrimination that still is there, and we acknowledge that. And that's a challenge too within these settings, because some of these community health settings, you don't want to say, hey, do you have hepatitis C? Have you thought about treatment? You have to find you have to do it in a very sensitive way. And some of these needle and syringe programs, they're very public in the way that they're laid out. So they're not very conducive to raising those conversations. And that's the challenge there, is because there is stigma associated with that. So it is an ongoing issue, an important one that needs to, you know, continually be confronted and dealt with, yeah. And that's through training, raising awareness. Yeah, it's a lot of different avenues.
The stigma may only be lessened with further conversation around hepatitis C, conversations like those from the Pennington Institute seminar that helped us to better understand those with the virus and the best ways to treat them.
The seminar, there was about 50 people or so there. It was the alcohol drug sector and the NSP sector. So we've got workers from a range of of organisations, not just needle and syringe program workers, but there were social workers and alcohol and drug workers. So they were people that do come in contact with people who currently inject. We had people talking from a research perspective and showing what some recent modelling is happening around, you know, introducing new models or looking at new models that might make the steps a lot easier. We had people that were presenting that work in a needle and syringe program. We had an integrated nurse who was actually one of the key workforce in offering up treatment, as well as a nurse practitioner. The idea now is that you don't need a specialist, as I said earlier, you don't need a specialist to prescribe, and you don't always need a GP, that there are some nurse practitioners too that are skilled up that can do this, that offer up the treatment. So hearing from different perspectives. And also someone from Hepatitis Victoria who was talking about their programs, the training programs that they do. And then we also talked about the training that we have been doing here at Pennington Institute, which received funding from the Northwest Melbourne Primary Health Network to do some training with NSP workers around the treatment. And acknowledging that we can do all this training, but if the environment is not an enabling environment that supports this, it's always going to be difficult. You can sort of train day and night, but if people are not supported in the workforce or that they don't feel as though they've got enough time to do this, so there is resourcing issues around staff being able to have the time and the confidence to talk about hepatitis C or to at least raise the topic with them. So, you know, it's a whole range of issues, but the important part was that we haven't in the past really had a seminar around the role of NSPs in hepatitis C treatment. I think collectively in this world of hepatitis, we've been caught up in very much a medical model, and it's been a model that's been driven by specialists, and then more recently by GPs, nurses, and we're slowly getting further and further out into the community, and that's what this seminar was about, what's going on the ground and the challenges that people are facing and the frustrations that some people are facing as well, in that we realise that we're not treating enough people and we're not necessarily having those conversations with people yet coming into those needle and syringe programs because the staff were not really prepared. What do you do with someone if you did have a conversation with them? There's not necessarily a clear pathway of where you can then refer them on to. So, and that's a really important part, that if you are going to engage someone about hepatitis C and they're interested, you have to be able to do something with them. You can't leave them hanging. You know, you do need to offer them up a way to get testing and then treatment. And that's where we're falling down, which we will get there.
Seminars like these are important for many reasons.
It's reminding people of the role of needle and syringe programs. It's reminding even the government of this incredible network of workers that is waiting to play a role in this area. And they'll get there eventually, but we've got some work to do to raise our profile, to remind people of the potential that is sitting there.
Despite all the work that still needs to be done, the future's looking bright for the treatment of hepatitis C.
The goal is to eliminate hepatitis C. Australia is the only country that is this far advanced. There's a lot of countries looking at us to see, are we going to be successful? How are we going about doing this? And you know, we need to pick up the game a bit. The federal government has invested a lot of money in these treatments, and you know, providing a lot of money and putting the treatments, which are becoming better and better, putting these on PBS is only half the equation, or it's a critical part, but there's other parts to the equation that we need to step up.
Darcy and Dean were talking Hep C treatments with Stephen McNally, the Deputy CEO at Pennington Institute, a non-profit organisation that works to identify and respond to substance use problems and their causes.
There is still more to come on Joy's The Informer, the news program from an LGBTI perspective.
Safe injecting rooms are just that, safe. And we can make a real difference to how we treat people using them, both mentally and physically. We have a treatment for hepatitis C, but not everyone is accessing it, and it's time we look at why. Dean Arcuri and Darcy Meehan continue their conversation of tackling Hep C treatment head-on in safe injecting rooms. But this time, it's not clinical, but personal.
Robert Lederman is a speaker and peer support worker for Hepatitis Victoria and Harm Reduction Victoria. He's also someone who's been treated for hepatitis C and knows firsthand the benefits of proper support for those who've contracted the virus. The Informer's Dean Arcuri spoke with Robert earlier this week to discuss the importance of needle and syringe programs, or NSPs, and how to reach the broader community and make sure they understand the treatments that are available.
Well, I think unlike your regular GP, say out in the suburbs, which most drug users do have bad experiences with, including myself, the needle and syringe programs were pretty much a bit of a respite for myself, particularly from the life on the street as a user and being homeless at that stage. And just being a non-judgmental environment, and the workers there are very empathetic towards, the client's needs and fully understanding of that. And it was just a safe place where one could go and be open and honest about their situation.
The programs and facilities are important not just for the service they provide, but also because of the space they give for those in need of support.
A while back, I was living on the street, pretty much just over a year ago, for approximately about 10 months. I've been sort of in and out of, different boarding house situations to crisis accommodation for a number of years, a lot of which was due to my addiction. And, the primary needle exchange where I was attending gave everything, not just clean equipment, but everything. It was a place to go for a shower, a cup of coffee, a friendly ear to have a chat to even, and including that, the doctor and nurses there were very cluey about someone such as myself, to my needs, having dealt with people myself on a regular basis, and it made it much easier for them to work with me
But the process isn't easy, especially for those living in communities without access to needle and syringe programs.
So, for instance, in your outer suburbs or regional areas where these services aren't really available, they might have secondary exchange programs, say through a local community health centre or hospital, and they haven't got the staff there who specialise in that sort of thing. And for one to go get treatment, to even just kickstart that treatment for Hep C, it could be up to, 4 to 5 visits. First of all, seeing your GP, then getting certain tests done, then going to another specialist where at the NSP, it's pretty much a one-stop shop. They can get the ball rolling so much quicker, and a lot of people would, especially people with addiction problems, would find it hard to prioritise certain things. I was shopping for that myself. My main motivation and first thought of the day was how to obtain my next shot, basically. And I always told myself, after I sort myself out there, then I'll go do what I have to do. But the truth is, as soon as you have that first one, your next thought is, how do I get my next one? So you put a lot of things on the back burners. And because most people who do use will pop into these services, and it's it. They advertise it, through posters, through word of mouth. The staff will always have a quick chat. And I do think it does need to be so much more.
Often it's the stigma that surrounds hepatitis C that turns people away from seeking treatment.
I'm not fully sure exactly how long I've actually had the virus. I'm guessing it would be around probably 16 to 17 years. I'd been a drug user for 30 years, an IV drug user for about 20. And I was, due to my GP, when I first got diagnosed, my local GP didn't have a very good bedside manner and really put me off seeing health professionals for quite a while. I felt the prejudice through him and a lot of other stigma-related issues too through some other health professionals. But when I did finally decide to go ahead with it, my new doctor basically said, look, we'll wait a couple of years. Your viral load isn't very severe. You're coping quite well. So he basically made me wait a bit longer and kept doing regular checkups with me, but until the new treatment became available, because as you may know, the old interferon treatment was quite a horrific experience. I've met some people who have gone through that, and it was horrendous from what I heard. So the first time I did actually clear the virus, but unfortunately, due to a relapse in drug use and a bit of stupidity on my behalf, I recontracted it. So I'm undergoing treatment again for a second time. I'm probably halfway through that now, and all's going very well. I'm happy to say, with the first time and the second time now, I've had zero side effects with this new medication.
There are also many other misconceptions when it comes to what treatment actually involves.
A lot of seasoned drug users are still under the impression that a lot of people I've spoken to and quoted think that, well, A, you have to be abstinent from any drug use. You know, you have to give up before they will treat you, which is false. I mean, people with IV, you know, do use intravenously, can still continue to use while undergoing treatment, as long as they practice those safe using practices and everything. But yeah, so that's not required. But in the past, it was a bit, you know, they tried to deter you from that. And people are still of the old mindset of, you know, the memory of the old interferon. So many people that I know are still unaware how good it is and how short it is. I mean, last time it only took me 2 months to clear the virus, and I'm just going to go for a 3 month this time. And yeah, it's looking very good.
That was Dean and Darcy speaking with Robert Lederman of Hepatitis Victoria and Harm Reduction Victoria. He's someone who's been treated for hepatitis C and knows firsthand the benefits of proper support for those who've contracted the virus.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
For the end of tonight's show, we return to where we started this week, in Amsterdam at the Bingham Cup, which saw teams of gay and inclusive rugby teams from across the globe come together for an international tournament. There's a special kind of inclusivity when it comes to rugby that really shines through. And tonight we talked to Wes, who had to play his ex-American teammates at this year's tournament with the Melbourne Chargers, and Rob, a former Melbourne Charger who now plays with the King's Cross Steelers, about how rugby is connecting gay players across the globe.
Wes, playing for Chargers A, reserve. Usually a wing, but today I ended up flanking.
You had a really interesting scenario where the very first game you were playing for the Bingham Cup with the Melbourne Chargers, the very first game of the tournament was against your old team back home.
Yeah. Needless to say, it was awkward, but fun. I think everybody was in good spirits. I was cheering for Chargers, obviously, but it was good seeing rivaling my old team.
So what made you want to play inclusive rugby?
I didn't have the chance in school. I grew up in a place where rugby didn't exist. I played soccer in the Caribbean, in Trinidad. You know, I didn't really fit in with the soccer crowd there. And then once I started getting more physical, getting lifting weights, basically, I was like, I'm going to put it to some good use. I'm going to find a good group of guys. I moved to San Francisco, found out about it, and that was it. I was hooked. I was crap. I was awful. But they welcomed me anyway. They took me in. They showed me the ropes. They had me there. Even though I was horrible, they would still pass me the ball.
And then you moved to Melbourne. What made you want to continue playing rugby with the team? Was it odd? Was it actually strange coming to a new town, joining a new team, and getting in amongst it with them?
I didn't really know how much I was going to become part of the team, but it was the first thing on my agenda was to meet the team, see what they were made of, go to practice with them. I wasn't sure if I'd be fit to play. I had a shoulder injury, and thought I would take it easy, ease in, but once I started playing again, that was it. I was sucked in. They made it easy for me to get there. They made it easy for me to come to training. They're a great group of guys that made me want to come out to practice, made me want to come to rugby, want to be better, want to play more. And so that's it. That's where I am now. And now I'm here with them, and they brought me here. I didn't think I would make it to this Bingham. I wasn't sure. I just moved all the way to Australia, but I'm here and I'm absolutely grateful for it, loving it, trying to give my all to this team for bringing me back here.
Now you've had your game against your old team playing with your current team. Was it intimidating or was it a whole lot of fun to be able to be here at Bingham and connect with teams all over the world, including your old team?
I think yesterday on the bus ride in, I was all nerves, all in my head, 200% nervous, shaking, ready to go, but also not ready. But once that whistle blew, once it started going, I was pumped. I was ready to jump in. I was ready to give it my all. I knew I'd have fun playing against them. I knew, like, now it's fun. Now I'm playing against big guys, and I'm not worried anymore about my shoulder. I'm not worried about my injury. It's fine. It's fine. I'm giving it my all. We're going to play this game as best as we could.
My name is Rob McLean, and I play for the King's Cross Steelers, and I'm a flanker.
Now, that's an Australian accent that you're saying there. Mm. So you, I know, last Bingham, you were playing for the Melbourne Chargers.
That's correct.
And when you moved countries, is it that you wanted to keep playing rugby?
I did want to keep playing rugby. When I first moved to the UK, I was trying to set up a team up in Scotland, in Dundee. We had a little bit of trouble doing that. I then got offered a job in London and moved down there, and the guys down there welcomed me with opening arms.
What has it been like learning to play with a whole new team?
It is a bit difficult at first, but then after a while it just clicks, and you know that you have people's personalities and you get along really, really well, and I found it fantastic.
So what is it like being here at Bingham when 2 years ago, when you were at the Bingham in Nashville, you were playing with the Melbourne Chargers, and now you're, you know, on opposing sides, basically?
I love the Chargers, and I'm still supporting them as much as I can whenever I can. But then I then have to switch my head into gear and understand that, you know, I'm here for this, for my team that I'm currently playing for. So off the pitch, I'm totally happily, like, I love hanging out with the Chargers and supporting them. On the pitch, I have to remember they are my opposition.
Did the fact that you were at Bingham previously and you'd played games against the Steelers and met people in the team make it easier to integrate?
Absolutely.
So do you think it just brings it to a whole nother level being here now and being able to meet and mix with all these teams from all around the world?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I'm now meeting people from Berlin and all these other countries that at some point, maybe later on in my life, I might move there. And it's just opening up, like, for me, a social door that when I get there, I've got friends, I've got people that I know, and it's not just a strange city and I'm by myself.
Rugby connects it all.
It does. It absolutely does. Doesn't matter if you're from, you know, the back ass of Australia to, you know, somewhere in Argentina or even in America, you're all connected and it's brilliant.
You'll hear highlights from the Sydney Convicts' win at this year's Bingham Cup in Amsterdam this weekend, or you can hear the play-by-play and post-game celebration interviews in our special Bingham Cup Grand Final Commentary podcast. It's just like being at the game, with a little more sass from the sidelines, with the Informer's Dean Arcurie and the Melbourne Chargers' Silas Palmer. You can find the podcast on the Informer's page on Joy's website at joy.org.au.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
That's it for another episode of The Informer, bringing you news and current affairs for Australia's LGBTI communities. A podcast of tonight's Informer will be available to download soon at joy.org.au or on your preferred podcast platform. Don't forget to follow us on social media, at The Informer on Joy 94.9 on Facebook and at The Informer Joy on Twitter. If you have a story or tip you'd like to share with us, get in touch at theinformer@joy.org.au. You've been listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9. I'm Tom Morgan.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.